Welcome to Power Play. On a day the taxpayers' bailout for Canada's largest aircraft manufacturer had the House of Commons in an uproar and Quebec's separatists in a lather, Brazil objected as well. The Minister of Economic Development will join us to explain why he felt it was necessary to give high-flying Bombardier a lift. Also ahead on the show, the first census release shows Canada had an updated population of about 35.15 million people who are draining from east to west. We'll ask what that foreshadows about Canada's future population patterns. And Trudeau's cabinet blitz continues to soften up the Trump administration for his upcoming visit. But a new poll says Canadians want the Prime Minister to stand up to the President. We'll connect with Washington for the latest and crunch the numbers on public opinion. And a coalition is calling on Justin Trudeau to take concrete steps to counter Islamophobia. We will talk to one of the Muslim leaders. But first, reaction to the government's $370 million Bombardier loan guarantee is throttling up in Quebec, out west, and from jet manufacturing competitors. Here's the interim Conservative leader fighting back this afternoon.
The Prime Minister thought through the message that he's sending to Canadians across the country when one favored business, Bombardier, receives hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer handouts while he's punishing others with higher taxes and a carbon tax. So my question is very simple. Does he plan to also bail out the dry cleaning shop in Fort McMurray or a diner in Stratford that's gone out of business because of his bad decisions?
All right, to discuss all that and more, we're joined by Canada's Economic Development Minister, Navdeep Bains, is here in the studio. Welcome to the program, Minister. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
In question period, she asked another good question. You spent a long time studying whether to give this assistance. And she asked, and you couldn't answer, how many jobs does this save or create?
Well, we did answer it in the House of Commons, and I mentioned it on several occasions. This investment into our aerospace sector secures 4,000 good quality jobs, and it creates an additional 1,500 jobs, as well as many indirect jobs, thousands of indirect jobs associated with the small businesses that are part of the ecosystem in the aerospace sector.
So we're not going to see any more layoffs out of Bombardier. They've been laying off a lot of people over the last year.
There's many factors that come into play, but the commitment that we got with respects to this investment in research and development does secure 4,000 jobs in the C-Series, as well as the Global 7,000, and that's what we're looking for. I mean, if we're to make an investment, to have a partnership, it really is about jobs and good quality jobs.
All right, they asked for $1.3 billion. You gave them about a third of that ask. What's that signal? Is it a vote of non-confidence that they didn't deserve more, or do they not need any more?
No, the situation changed. When they came to us in 2015, their market capitalization was less than $2 billion. They hadn't sold any C-Series planes. Now, if you fast forward till today, they've certified their C-Series planes. They've sold to Air Canada. They've sold to Delta. Their financial situation has improved. Their market capitalization is now more than doubled. So our focus was never really on the financial situation. It was really a focus on innovation, on research and development, and good quality jobs. And those were our guiding principles in our conversations, and that's the outcome that we achieved. We focused on good quality jobs and making sure that this particular sector remains competitive for years to come.
I remember, like, back in May, one of the vice presidents said, excuse me, that, you know, he didn't think government support was necessary or needed at that stage of the game. Why was it needed now? They're even in better shape than they were in last May.
If you look at the global aerospace scene, it's very important to have government partnerships with this sector if we are to compete globally. That's one key observation. And the other one is that our government has been very committed to innovation. And there's a lot of research and development done in the aerospace sector. And Bombardier plays a leadership role when it comes to that. And for us, if you look at the jobs that come out of this investment, they on average pay 60% more than a comparable job in other manufacturing sectors. So for us, it was really a focus on the type of jobs that we wanted, good quality jobs. We wanted to focus on new smart solutions, and that's where research and development comes in, because we're investing in people. We're investing in engineers, we're investing in technicians, we're investing in project managers. And that type of investment is really important because, you know, we have kids. If they graduate, they want a good quality job. This is a great opportunity for them. So it's really about securing short-term opportunities and also having long-term opportunities in the job market as well.
I'm curious because there are companies all across Canada struggling that may have, you know, we helped the auto sector in Ontario, and there's a oil sector in Alberta.
And the shipbuilding.
Yeah,
that's right.
You're helping the shipbuilding, but the oil sector I know is up for a debate in the House of Commons. I mean, where's the line? How do you decide who gets government help and who doesn't? What's the criteria?
So the criteria is really what kind of investment are we getting for taxpayers? What kind of return are we getting on the types of jobs we're creating? And what kind of competitive advantages are we creating? So if you're looking, for example, at the investment that we made with Bombardier and particularly the jobs, these are state-of-the-art planes. The C-Series is a game changer in its sector. The Global 7000 is, again, a very high-end plane that creates a lot of unique opportunities for the company to grow. So we're really focused on growth opportunities. We're focused on innovation. We're focused on, you know, all sectors across the country. And, you know, we've been very consistent when it comes to the automotive sector. When our recent announcement in Honda, for example, again, the investment that they made of $500 million reduced their carbon footprint for their facility by 44%. So we're looking for those kinds of investments that are green, that are innovative, and across the board, across the country.
I know Brazil's upset. They say you violate the World Trade Organization. Are you worried that this could be a problem?
No, we feel that this investment is very consistent with our international obligations and commitments, and we're willing to defend that position if need be. But we're going to continue to focus on innovation. We're going to continue to focus on investments and focus on jobs, and that's a priority for our government.
Brazil's got a habit of whining about this, haven't they? I think they whined the last time when the Quebec government kicked in.
I was about to say, we can't control what they do, but we can take ownership of our own microeconomic policies, and we're going to continue to invest.
All right, final question. The Parti Québécois leader says, you know, this is just proof that they're not willing to support Quebec industry. They help the auto industry a lot more and they're not helping us enough. This is grounds for us to going it alone. What do you say to that?
Well, this is bigger than Quebec. This is an investment in our overall aerospace sector that benefits different regions across the country, right? And this impacts our supplier base. There's 950 suppliers that benefit. Again, they're located across the country. So this is really about our investment in the aerospace sector. We want to strengthen that sector. It's our government's commitment to innovation. And we're not a government that's going to pit one region against the other. We want to move beyond that divisive politics and really focus on growing the economy.
All right. Minister, thanks for coming. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, go catch a plane. Well, maybe not. All right. Let's bring in our all-party panel of MPs to discuss this and more. Nathan Cullen is an NDP MP from British Columbia, Liberal Stephen McKinnon, Parliamentary Secretary from Quebec, and Gordon Brown, a Conservative MP from Ontario, just outside of Ottawa. Welcome, Gordon. Haven't had you on before.
Glad to be with
you. Nice to have you with us, so I'll pick on you first. Bombardier bailout. Is this a hand up to a high-flying company or a hand out to a corporate welfare bomb?
Well, this is a hand out to a company. We've got companies all across Canada, thousands of them, in fact, who are being punished by the policies of this government, and they're not getting a handout. And tonight we're going to have a debate in the House of Commons about the energy sector and the challenges that they're facing, and we're not seeing any support for that. But this is picking winners and losers, and we're going to look closely at this deal.
Well, you guys gave to General Motors as a government.
Well, that was a situation where there was a program that was available to all companies, not just one company in particular.
Oh. I thought it was targeted, but anyway.
Well, it was targeted to all companies in the auto sector who could take advantage of it.
Okay, but all right.
Not all of them did.
All right, that's true. Nathan?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to go back to the auto sector.
Let's not go there. Let's just have
well,
to stick
no,
with the
I
planes.
Mean, it's, I guess your question is fair, which is the government being consistent? Because if you want to look around at all the different industries, those that innovate, and that goes across from forestry and the energy sector to auto to aerospace. And I think it's fair for other industries to say, do we have access to the same loans that Bombardier just got access to? This feels a bit like one of those, you ever see it, there's a job posting or something and it's, or a call for grants from the government that's so narrowly defined that only one group can really ever apply for it. And they say, no, it was open to everybody. I think that was actually a bit the case with General Motors. It was an offer to the auto sector, but
well, there's not too many airline manufacturers.
That's the nature of the aerospace industry. Yeah. There are not that many airline. And every country subsidizes, maybe Stephen knows one that doesn't, but every country does to one extent in one way or another. Mm-hmm. I think for us as New Democrats, the thing that we were looking for is actually some more details in what is being offered. The government came forward with those claims that Minister Baines just put forward, but not a lot of details in the deal as are jobs guaranteed, are jobs secured, which ones, where is Bombardier accountable back to the Canadian taxpayer who's loaning them the money? And I think those are fair questions to ask. I hope that as the deal starts to come out, we actually get to see those details.
But in principle, you're okay with what they did?
I'm mixed, to be honest. I mean, our official party position, of course, is the aerospace industry is key. Bombardier is key within that sector. The fact that the company asked for this much, got this much, and we don't see the details is worrisome. But in general, if Canada isn't keeping pace with the other countries around the world, do we lose those jobs? Do they bleed out to the States and to Europe and to Brazil? These are highly mobile jobs, right? Yeah. So they can take a hike if we're not careful.
I mean, Steve, I know you want to jump in. Your minister kind of articulated it reasonably well, but I'm curious.
Reasonably?
Very well.
I thought he was pretty good, actually. Yes.
All right. I'm sorry to be subjective. He did okay. I want to get your thoughts, though, on winners, picking winners and losers, because you're seeing this take note debate tonight in the House of Commons on the energy sector, which is hurting pretty badly.
Absolutely.
Does the government wade into there and try and pick winners or losers, or is this just a special occasion and you don't?
Well, what this government's shown, I think, very nimbly is that it's identifying sectors of Canadian growth, sector by sector, dialoguing with the leaders in those sectors, and doing everything it can to work on their priorities. In the aerospace sector, it's a growth industry. Aviation is a global growth industry. Bombardier, among other companies, but Bombardier, I think it's fair to say, stands alone as a Canadian iconic brand around the world. And it supports an ecosystem of literally hundreds of suppliers right across the country. Mm-hmm. In the case of the energy sector, what they've always said is that there are a couple of priorities. The biggest one, though, market access. And I think this government has moved very boldly to support market access for our energy firms. We're seeing some stirrings, some good news. It's early. We certainly don't want to be doing victory laps, but we're seeing some stirrings of reinvestment and new investment in our energy and our extraction industries. That industry has a good story to tell as well about investments in lowering its carbon footprint. And the government supports industries in all sorts of ways. It supports industries in labor market training. It supports industries right across the country in innovation and in lowering its carbon footprint. And in the case of aerospace, I think we've made a very judicious investment.
One question I think it's fair to put to the government, none of us are aerospace experts on this panel, but Bombardier has certainly had some problems over the last number of years. Getting the C-Series plane that Minister Bain talked about out the door was way over budget, way behind. And while it seems like the ship has righted, I guess you asked earlier, was this a vote of confidence? The company wanted this much. Minister Bain said, well, things have changed. They feel fine with this amount of money now. We'll see. But for Canadian taxpayers, who are the ones writing the check on this loan, it is now that Canada comes in again with Bombardier and says, we're putting a vote of confidence with you, is the company fully on track?
It seems only fair to ask. I mean, in the House of Commons today, the Democrats actually accused us of not supporting Bombardier enough. They were actually parroting the lines of the separatists in Quebec. And in the case of the Conservatives, they were suggesting we not support the company at all.
They shortchanged you last week. Now you're taking dominating the
company. The company hasn't paid back some of the loans that they were given previously. And as well, the best way to create jobs across the country is to lower taxes and get government out of the way. And this is a case of government intervening. But like I said before, we want to make sure that we look at this closely and
saying the energy sector needs help, right?
We do.
And what do you see that in the form of?
First of all,
some
of these punishing policies that this government is bringing forward, especially carbon taxes, that are going to be even making it more difficult, especially in provinces like Alberta, and it's having its impact here in Ontario as well.
Carbon tax did not lower the world price of oil, which I think any expert would tell you is the cause of Canada. I mean, Canada has a reasonably high cost of extracting its resources. And the world price of oil crashed. Market access pipelines will help us reduce that gap. Yeah. Well, I have not.
We'll
reduce that gap between world price and the price that Canadians derive.
Let's just account for this, that if the policies of either of these parties were actually working, Canada wouldn't have lost 500,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 10 years. The fact is that the manufacturing center broadly is in desperate need, not just in the aerospace sector, but in auto and value added across the board. The only pipeline and energy strategy that Liberals put forward is the same one Stephen Harper put forward, which is raw dilution diluted bitumen out to markets is going to save the day. We know we need a value-added strategy, well, and that's what the Notley government has actually called for, and the Liberals have been quite crickets. Okay. So, no, all those pipelines that they're trying to approve
that's
are
not
raw,
accurate.
Diluted, no, yes,
there are all sorts of downstream industries in the energy sector.
Yeah, in the United States and China, congratulations.
No, LNG.
You just sent,
LNG and natural gas, there are all sorts of
you're being sued
promising
for
investments.
Okay, we're trying to...
promising investment. Well, look, he's on the one hand, he does not get to decry loss of employment in Canada, and on the other hand, say that we can't, we're going to get sued if we venture ahead with an LNG plant.
Loss of employment in
this
Canada.
This is the eternal dilemma of the New Democrats. They have a LEAP manifesto. They have a LEAP manifesto that suggests we close down the oil sands.
Allow me this. Value-added strategies to our great natural wealth in this country would actually create the manufacturing jobs that both of these parties have talked about ad nauseum, but don't seem to do much about.
I got to quickly get your thoughts. Canada has set up, or the Trudeau government set up a little sort of a
war room
of eight persons who are working full-time lobbying the United Nations to get us this temporary seat on the UN Security Council, where, frankly, Russia, China, and the U.S. decide what's going to happen anyway. Mm. Is this a good use of time? I mean, we tried before, and we lost to what, Portugal or someone like that?
In 2010, we did not get the seat on the Security Council.
But it's necessary to get one, though.
Not necessarily, but if you look at what our government had done, things like the Child and Newborn Maternal Health Initiative that was praised by Ban Ki-moon, the initiative by Rana Ambrose to get the International Year of the Girl, and many initiatives that Canada had taken the lead. Justin Trudeau likes to say that Canada's back. Well, Canada never went anywhere. We were always standing up for Canadian values at the UN. The fact was that in 2010, we didn't go along, and we stood up for Israel. We were steadfast in our support for the state of Israel, and that cost us the seat.
We're almost out of time. Quickly, why should we chase this? What's the big prize here?
Of course it's important. It's the Security Council. You know, you mentioned the permanent members, they have a veto, but Canada has an opportunity that doesn't come around very often. We did, indeed, we were unsuccessful in 2010. We have an opportunity to actually put forward a case, put forward our values, put forward the kinds of things that Canada stands for, and to take
we'll get it anyway.
Cases of maple syrup.
We want to take a greater leadership role in the world.
Right now, salmon is going down to New York in droves, hoping that the Security Council vote can finally be secured.
This is an effort, wild smoked salmon,
and then we're talking. But, of course, it's important to be in that kind of conversation. But I think the thing consuming the UN right now is Donald Trump and what he's going to be doing to multilateralism writ large.
This conversation's not over. We'll carry it on. All right.
Thank you all.
We'll see you next week. Coming up, we will go to Washington for the latest in Canada's cabinet blitz of the U.S. Capitol, which sets up the looming summit between the Prime Minister and Donald Trump. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, there's a lot of speculation about when the Prime Minister will pay a visit to President Trump in Washington and who the next American ambassador to Canada will be. We got a few hints from the President's press secretary today. Here's what Mr. Spicer had to say.
I will have further updates on the Prime Minister's schedule tomorrow, either later today or tomorrow. I'm not at a position where I can finalize that. With respect to the ambassador, we have no additional ambassador nominations or announcements to make on that front. With respect to the agenda, as the president spoke with Prime Minister Trudeau a few weeks ago, they talked about trade and security and commerce, and I think all of that's going to be discussed at the time.
Please send Sarah Palin. Please send Sarah. Okay. This comes as Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland continues her visit to the U.S. Capitol. She had a meeting today with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. All right. Let's go to Washington for more on the grin, grip, and gab session with CTV's senior political correspondent Glenn McGregor. Glenn, it was the Foreign Affairs Minister and the Secretary of State today at meeting. What did she say came out of that meeting?
Well, she said they talked about NATO, they talked about trade, they talked about security, the topics that you would expect. And they also talked about border tariffs. Freeland said that Canada would respond appropriately if the U.S. tried to impose new tariffs on trade going across the borders. Not really a threat, but it was fairly forceful language that she used. And this is all part of what she's calling a granular diplomacy. New phrase I hadn't heard before until now, but I think she's referring to all this outreach that her and other cabinet ministers are doing. Harjit Sajjan, the defense minister, was here a few days ago to meet with James Mattis, his counterpart as the Secretary of Defense. Bill Morneau, finance minister, is going to be in Washington tomorrow. And then, of course, we're going to have the prime minister visit at some point in the future. We still don't know exactly when that's going to be. Keep hearing rumors about dates, and then those rumors keep getting shot down. The interesting thing, Don, I'm finding here is the outreach not just to the White House, because that's been going on for a while. We heard all those stories over the past month about how top officials in the prime minister's office were heading down to Trump Plaza to meet with Jared Kushner and having this, trying to open up the channels to the White House in the back door. It looks like they're kind of expanding that now and really aiming at members of Congress, like Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, John McCain, Bob Corker, who's the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. So they're really trying to kind of expand the reach of that charm offensive, full court press, whatever you want to call it. And I think the idea is that may be the best stopgap measure against any attempts from the White House to really dramatically overhaul the NAFTA agreement.
Right. I keep getting told by people that know these things better that our problem is new administrations, when they come in, Canada's an afterthought, and we really have to fight elbow aside a lot of people to make sure we're seen and heard, and that the importance of our relationship is underlined. I guess that's sort of the big picture here, isn't it?
I think so. That doesn't seem to be a problem so far. I mean, it seems like Chrystia Freeland is here like every second week. They're getting meetings with important people. When the cabinet was meeting out in Calgary a couple of weeks ago, they had Trump's top economic advisor, Stephen Schwarzman, came out for that meeting. So they certainly seem to have a channel open. Question is the message getting through? One of the interesting things that came out of the meeting with Paul Ryan was that his office put out a press release after he'd met with Freeland, talking about some of the issues that you would expect, security, the longstanding economic relationship. But he also mentioned access to dairy markets. And this is, I think, a little bit of a red flag that Canada should be nervous about, because the Americans don't like some of the supply management that goes on in Canada in the dairy industry. They feel it's protectionist. They think there's other tariffs that have been added on top of that, including the import of skim milk to make cheese. And that's something it looks like they are going to be gunning for. This is obviously an important issue for a guy like Paul Ryan, coming from Wisconsin, which is a major dairy producer, major cheese producer, as any Green Bay Packers fan will tell you. We've all seen them wearing those cheese head hats. So this is something that's new on the radar. And Freeland today, in a teleconference with journalists, saying that she defended the industry when she's talking to Ryan and will continue to defend it as she always does. But I think this is unsettling talk, and it looks like it's one of those issues that is in the crosshairs as the U.S. moves to renegotiate NAFTA. But could be an upside for Canadian consumers, though, because it could mean if there was more freer flow of dairy products from the United States coming into Canada, could mean cheaper prices for milk, for cheese, for yogurt, things like that.
All right. We'll see what the finance minister does. I know his counterpart, the Secretary of the Treasury, hasn't been appointed yet, but we'll see what happens tomorrow. Glenn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate this.
Thanks, Don.
All right, we are on the eve of this prime ministerial meeting. Whenever that happens, a new Nanos poll is particularly timely. Nick Nanos of CTV's Pulse Street joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hey, Don.
You know, Chrystia Freeland coming out saying, basically, if they raise quotas or raise tariffs on us, we'll do the same thing back. Kind of reading your polling numbers, at least what public opinion is saying. What do you read in these numbers?
Well, it's not possible because it was just released today. So they're doing their thing.
Met them today.
They're doing their thing,
they did,
and we're
they
doing
did it this
ours.
Morning.
You know, we in the poll that we did with the Globe and Mail, what we asked was how Canadians felt on whether we should be considering having a potential trade war if the U.S. decides to put tariffs on Canadian goods. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the numbers, they're actually quite striking. You can see that 58% of Canadians support or somewhat support having a trade war, while only 35% oppose or somewhat oppose. So it looks like, you know, that little bit of the Irish, I guess, so to speak, mm-hmm. in the Canadians when it comes to retaliating if the U.S. put tariffs on Canadian goods.
But, you know, this is the old thing, like we want him to stand up to Trump. We want to play hardball, but then we realize there's consequences, and it could be nasty if we get too belligerent with this guy.
Yeah.
Is there any sense that people understand you got to be get along, to, you know, go along, basically?
Well, I think for sure. You know, the thing is that this, the relationship with the United States now is fraught with what I'll say risks for the prime minister. There are domestic political risks, because if he's too chummy with Donald Trump, that won't play well to the liberal base and to many Canadians. There are business risks, because the U.S. is our biggest trading partner. If we mess that up, that's trouble.
Yeah.
And then there are diplomatic risks, because what we don't want to do is to unnecessarily escalate things. So it's going to be, can we say, walking on eggshells?
Walking on eggshells? You can
perhaps.
Say that.
Yeah, okay.
You can say that. All right, we do have another one on the Prime Minister protecting Canada's economic interests. What do you read in those numbers?
Well, you know, we asked Canadians how confident they were in the government protecting Canadian economic interests, and you can see that even when you roll up confident and somewhat confident, the numbers aren't too bad, but the reality is that intensity of confidence is actually quite low. Only 17% of Canadians are outright confident that the government can protect our interests in a NAFTA renegotiation, mm-hmm. while another 40% are somewhat confident. So not great scores, a lot of mushiness, so to speak. In terms of confidence, and I think it speaks to the fact that, you know, to your point, they know that the Americans, they don't have all the cards, but they have more than we do.
And they, is there concern that Trudeau's just too nice and Trump could be too nasty?
Well, I'm not sure if that's the case, and we don't have research to speak to that, but I think for average Canadians, they know that Trump believes and says that he is a great negotiator.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's clear that he starts off by asking for something. So then the question is, what are they going to ask? And then what will the response of the Canadian government be? Nobody knows.
Well, they also like, you know, they appear to like, and this is not your poll, it's a Main Street one. It basically says on economic policy, 53% of Canadians approve of what Trump's doing versus 43% of Canadians approve what Trudeau's doing. And his disapproval rating on economic policy is 41%. Now, I should stress this is about a month old, no, 3 weeks mm-hmm. old, these numbers. Things might have changed dramatically, but it certainly shows there's some doubts about Trudeau and his economic handling, and they seem to like what Trump's doing, which is being real brash and loud.
Well, actually, I think there's probably one focus that Trump has that Canadians like, even though it's not necessarily in our best interest, his fight for jobs. It's pretty clear that he is almost single-minded in wanting to fight, keep American jobs and attract jobs, whether it's building a wall, slapping on tariffs, attacking his allies. It's all about jobs. And, you know, the thing is that I'm sure that resonates. I think the challenge for the Liberal government is that they have been focused on other issues. You know, in the past, they've been focused on democratic renewal. They've been distracted with the prime minister's vacation. Mm-hmm. They've been distracted with fundraising. Mm-hmm. And they haven't been able to focus as much on jobs. So I would say this is not a personality vote for Trump. I think this is a tip of the hat to a leader who is focusing on fighting for jobs for his country.
All right. Well, I'll see if that changes. All right, Nick, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right, before the prime minister decides to travel to the U.S., he's off to Europe next week. He's going to address the European Parliament. I think that's the first time a Canadian prime minister has done so. And then he has a face-to-face meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Trudeau's Berlin visit with Merkel, as she's arguably Europe's most influential politician, comes as the EU tries to deal with Donald Trump and his protectionist inward-looking America First foreign policy. So that's going to be an interesting trip. After the break, earlier today, Muslim leaders call on the governments at all levels to act against Islamophobia. We'll talk to one of them right after these messages. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, Canadian Muslim organizations from across Canada were on Parliament Hill today calling for unified action to fight Islamophobia. The executive director of the National Council of Canadian Muslims is Isan Gardi, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, I have to tell you, there was this national uprising of anger at the mosque shootings and a resolve to make sure this never happens again. How do you use what you were proposing today to make sure that that drive stays alive, that emotion continues, and that resolve continues?
Well, I think that you mentioned on that we had these national shows of unity and support, and I have to say that those were extremely heartening, and the communities across the country really, really appreciated. But as you pointed out, it's important now that we don't lose momentum, that that's the biggest fear, that in a week from now, 2 weeks from now, people are going to forget about this, and we're going to go back to the same old, same old. Mm-hmm. So what we're hoping for now is that we recognize that we've had this environment, this climate of rising Islamophobia that has well documented, that NCCM has been documenting on our website, nccm.ca, that other organizations, including Stats Can, have documented that in the past 3 years, hate crimes targeting Canadian Muslims have actually doubled. And that's been echoed by other other agencies as well, like the Toronto Police Service. And that we now use this or make sure that these people didn't die in vain. Right? So that we can actually take concrete steps. And that's why we're calling, Don, on all levels of government to be involved at the municipal, the provincial, and the federal level.
You also, I mean, you bring in police, you need education, you're calling on them. What do you want the police to do? What can police do to try and, you know, stamp this out?
Right. Well, police services play an important role. We know that police services across Ontario, at least, and in other provinces as well, many of them are under-resourced, and many of them don't even have hate crimes units. So it's important that resources are provided for these police services so that they have the tools and the equipment and training necessary to be able to actually confront and deal with hate crimes and hate incidents. At the same time, it's also important that police services are reporting the hate crimes and hate incidents that they are receiving to their police services board as well as publicly, so that we can actually gauge where we're at. The data from Statistics Canada that we receive is 2 years in the past, so we don't really have a sense of where things are at right now, which is why NCCM is monitoring as well. But we need government as well to do its part.
I know this government's trying to help make sure the border walls don't go up to Muslims traveling just because, you know, Islamophobia reigns even at customs, I guess. They've got the Nexus problem sorted out, apparently. There was anyone using Nexus from one of the seven banned countries was having trouble getting across the border. Now, apparently, that's lifted. But what do they need to do so that you don't approach a border guard and resign yourself to the fact, I'm going to be held up here, there's religious profiling going on? How do you end that kind of fear, if you will, at the border?
Well, I think this is a bigger and a broader discussion that will require some further analysis and conversations. But what I can say is that obviously the Canadian government has a responsibility and a duty to look after and to care for its citizens and to protect its the rights of its citizens. And so it's important that they take that role seriously and they, you know, work with their counterparts in the new U.S. administration to try and make sure that issues that Canadians are facing are resolved quickly and expeditiously.
I think a National Day of Remembrance is a good idea because it would focus the mind. I don't know if you need government to do it, like the Polytechnique massacre. There is a day dedicated. Is that what you're kind of hoping to replicate, that sort of thing?
At the federal level, that is one of our asks, is to have a National Day of Remembrance and action on Islamophobia so that we make sure that this is something that people are cognizant and aware of. At the same time, there's also a federal motion by MP Ikra Khalid, M103, which is calling for the government to really, a number of things. One, to condemn Islamophobia and all forms of systemic discrimination, and to recognize that there's an environment of rising hatred and a climate of fear, and also to actually study the issue, to look at it from an evidence-based perspective, to be able to look at it, the context, to do needs analysis with communities so that we can come up with real solutions.
Okay, good time. Well, let's hope that passes. Thank you. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank you so much,
Doug. All right, coming up, it's the ultimate paint-by-numbers portrait of Canada. The first statistics from the 2016 mandatory census rolled out today. We'll look at what Canada looks like with those new numbers. Please stay with us. It was Census Data Dump Day in Ottawa as the first batch of statistics from the 2016 mandatory census were released. It shows we have 35.15 million people living in Canada, a growth rate since 2011, which is the highest in the G7 countries. For more, let's bring in Statistics Canada Director General Karen Mihorian. She joins me in the studio. Nice to have you, Karen.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let's just go quickly through some of the fun stuff.
Sure.
Fastest growing city?
Calgary, Alberta.
Still? Isn't there a big oil crash going on there?
It continues to show strength. You got to remember the census. It's 2 points in time. So 2011 compared to a certain point in time in 2016.
Right.
Between that five-year period, we're still seeing strong growth in Calgary.
What percentage growth have they gone up in that 5 years?
It was a little over 14%, 14.6%.
Wow. So it wouldn't have caught any migration out of the city yet or a flatlining of growth yet? Really?
Well, we can look to our population estimates program. So we have seen through that program that uses census counts and adjusts for various things. We have noticed through that program that the last couple of years there has been a slowing of the growth rate overall in Alberta. So we're starting to see a little bit of that from that program. But again, census 2 points in time over the 5 year, there was strong growth.
Who's slowest growing city or
shrinking? The only St. John, New Brunswick, mm-hmm. In fact, the province of New Brunswick is the only province where we did see a decline in population. Wow. Generally, we are continuing to see, as we have in previous censuses, this growth of east to west. Mm-hmm. For the first time since the Prairie provinces have joined Confederation, those three provinces led the charge in population growth, which is interesting.
Is that, you're talking about Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta? Because BC is growing like crazy, too.
Yes, so Alberta was number one, followed by Saskatchewan and Manitoba amongst the provinces, mm-hmm. and then BC as well, their growth rate was above the national average. So if you combine Western Canada, we now have a third of the Canadian population residing in Western Canada.
That's got to be a sign of the politicians. You got to take the West seriously. The West wants in because they're a big player in the scene now.
Yeah.
I guess you don't want to get into that.
No, I'm not going to get into that.
That doesn't tell you the numbers. Okay, I want to talk about urban concentration. Yeah. It certainly sounds like that continues a trend that's been going on probably for 100 years. Rural, urban.
That's right. So right now, Canada's population sits at about 80 to 83% urbanized. Wow. Again, amongst the G7 countries, we're one of the most urbanized countries. What we're noticing is in the large CMAs, that it's the fringe areas of those CMAs that seem to be growing. So we're seeing
CMA is
Census Metropolitan Area. I'm sorry, okay. Stats can jargon. So Census Metropolitan Areas, we're noticing the areas just outside of those. So the more just on the fringe of those, mm-hmm. we're noticing more growth. So you're seeing a little bit more urban spread. And then even amongst the what we would call rural areas or consider rural areas, those that are closer to the urban areas seem their growth rates are slightly higher than the real rural areas. So for sure, a definite move more to urbanization.
I found it interesting. There's one region that seems to be, for want of a better term, more fertile than the rest. What are we talking about there?
So first, overall in Canada, since the late 1990s, we have noticed that our population growth has been fueled by immigration, about mm-hmm. two-thirds, and one-third what we call natural increase, and that's basically your birth minus your death or fertility. We're seeing that trend because we are an aging population, low fertility rates. For Nunavut, as you were referring to, their population growth, they were by far the highest growing area in the country, even more so than
wow.
Alberta. But their growth is completely fueled by what we would consider natural increase.
Okay, and very quickly, I'm out of time, but you're looking into the future and you're seeing a time where mm-hmm. migration is the only growth.
Yeah, so if you look at sort of the projections going forward, as I said, since the late 1990s, mm-hmm. we've certainly been seeing that. Going into even 2050, by and large, our growth will be relying on immigration.
And by 2050-something,
Yep, very small, very, very tiny natural increase.
All right, you make statistics interesting. Thank you. We'll see you at the next Census Dump Day.
Thanks, Karen. Appreciate you coming in.
After the break, our wild and wonderful press gallery digs into the Prime Minister's upcoming travel schedule and the disappearing official opposition leader. Please stay with us. Welcome back. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to reunite our press gallery dynamos. Susan Delacourt writes for iPolitics and the Toronto Star. Jolene Bellavance is bureau chief for La Presse. Welcome back. Nice to see you guys always. Prime Minister is going to Europe, deal with the European Parliament. I don't know, it's kind of coincidental, but we have a new ambassador going to both those, and it's the same guy, Stéphane Dion. Is this like, meet Stéphane Dion, or sorry, don't be upset that we've got one ambassador for two places, or what do you make of it, Susan?
I think there's a little bit of that. You know, go over there and make sure that, I'm sure you've heard the same thing I have, is that that's a bit of a tough sell over there in Europe, you know, all of trying to sell a double duty ambassador. But as we were talking earlier, I think this is more because this is a PMO fixated on Donald Trump. I don't think anything they do is without Donald Trump in mind. And I think it's quite deliberate to go and be with Angela Merkel, mm-hmm. the progressive voice of the world, or Europe at least, mm-hmm. before he goes to see Trump. So he's sort of amassing, you know, the international army, going in there saying, well, you know, I've been out there and seen what's going on in the world. I think this is, if not all, at least in large part, about arming himself to walk in and see Trump.
Interesting. Yeah. What do you think, JD?
Well, about Mr. Dion, there is some resistance in some countries about having a double duty diplomat. And some countries are demanding some explanation to the Trudeau government as to why they appointed Mr. Dion to those double duties. But in terms of Mr. Trudeau's trip, I think it's very significant for the following reason. There will be a vote probably in the European Parliament before Mr. Trudeau arrive on CETA. And at the same time, they want the same vote in Ottawa, so simultaneous approbation of the deal, to send a signal that, see, we can make progressive deals. And so that would be sort of a diplomatic lesson to Mr. Trump before going to the U.S.
That's
have this approved before at the same time. So that's something that Mr. Trudeau wants to work on and make sure that there's a signal delivered to Mr. Trudeau through the European capitals.
And he's going to go to Washington, and we've seen McManus's poll says basically stand up to him, and Chrystia Freeland today more or less did that.
Yeah.
Can you play hardball against a U.S. administration that can, you know, sort of roll over on us and squish our little mouse?
Well, I think you may be able to do it indirectly, and not directly in the face of Mr. Trump, because, you know, his character is quite unpredictable. So you do buy people around him and the people who will listen to what Canada has to say. So I think it was the proper way to do it with Mr. Tilson, delivered the news. He will digest that and then go back to Mr. Trump. So Mr. Trump will have to deal with that, but not in the face, get it in the face from Madame Freeland. So I think it's a wise strategy to go around. And that's been sort of the strategy of the Trudeau government. Circle Mr. Trump by making close relationship with people around him who have sort of some sort of influence around him, not confront him directly. And that's been his strategy so far.
Mr. Trump, I don't know him personally, but but I feel I do because I read Twitter. he's somebody who would respect strength, I would imagine, and respect a show of strength. And I don't think it's a good idea for Canadians to cower in the face of that. That being said, I love Nick's polls, but I think the interesting question to ask Canadians always when you ask them, should we do this, at what cost? Like, should we have a fight with Donald Trump if it means you may lose your job? Then they may change their mind. It's like those polls about going to war or fighting. It's all well and good until somebody actually has to step up.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as Justin Trudeau is being asked to do the tough stuff, but I think if you ask Canadians, should we do the tough stuff if it means that your job may be lost or that Canada may lose a spot?
But the meeting between Madame Freeland and Mr. Tilson today was, I think, a key moment in the Canadian U.S. relationship, because Mr. Tilson knows Canada quite well, having been, you know, in charge of ExxonMobil. He knows Alberta. He knows the economic landscape of Canada. Yeah. And I think he knows the close economic relationship that Canada and the United States have together. So I think that message that was really given to Mr. Tilson, if, you know, it's correct, that Mr. Freeland has mentioned that if you want something, play hard, I can play hard too, I think was the right one to deliver to this person. And he's the right person to deliver to, knowing that he knows Canada.
And it sounds like, you know, in both cases, both the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, they got along pretty well with these ministers, and they're probably two people that could stand up to Trump and say, "Oh, come on, you don't want to penalize Canada. We got to get along with these guys."
I mean, this is an administration. I've been watching a lot of CNN this week, and it does look like they've been a bit humbled. I wouldn't say, you know, Trump-style humbled, but it does look like they need some friends right now, and they know they need some friends. I was watching Sean Spicer yesterday, very. Certainly not all Melissa McCarthy with the media. He was, I think they realized that maybe the first 2 weeks have been a bit of a clown show. Yeah. And what better friend, what better way to show that you can get along with people than with your old friend Canada? So we may be part of a reputation salvaging exercise.
And also, I mean, Mr. Trump has come to office with high expectations from his supporters. He's got to deliver the goods, and the goods are jobs. And by declaring sort of a commercial war against Canada may cost USA some jobs. And so the results expected of him will not be there on the dotted line. So he's got to be careful with the kind of hardball he's playing with Canada still,
Very
I would
quickly,
say.
Ronna Ambrose, after her yacht holiday, the interim conservative, yeah, that is her, she usually comes out Wednesday and talks to reporters after the caucus meeting, and she bolted right after question period, and we've asked her to come on this show every day this week, and we've been told, no. Is this gun-shy behavior from the yacht revelations that are doing this? And if so, shouldn't she just come out like Trudeau did and said, all right, I did the island thing and the helicopter thing. I'm going to the ethics commissioner. End of story. What do you think? How do you damage control this?
Maybe she wrote to Stephen Harper and asked him how to handle this. I'm surprised she has been so not Stephen Harper, so face the music. I think it's inexplicable. I really thought she was going to come out today. I'm surprised she didn't.
Quick last word to you.
It's been an embarrassing moment for Ronna Ambrose. It's too bad because she's had a very good run so far as interim leader, except for this faux pas. And that's, there's a saying in English, when you live in a glass stone, you don't throw big rocks at other people.
Glass house.
Glass house, sorry.
We have one about goats and cabbages. Yeah.
You don't throw rocks at somebody, but I think that's the lesson that comes back to
us. I haven't seen any questions from her on Justin Trudeau since this came out. All right. Thank you both. We'll see you next week. Glass stones. Okay. That's it for today's Political Power Plays. Scott Laurie standing by with the latest news headlines. Thanks for watching the broadcast or listening to our podcast. So here's how you can reach us with show reactions, ideas. We are back tomorrow with all the big moves from Parliament Hill across the country and around the world. Hope you can join us at this time on CTV News Channel.